Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In 1865, America is just at the end of its Civil War. Against the backdrop of a nation still bleeding from the painful wounds of conflict, poets and scholars are meeting in a sun-yellow colonial mansion in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to review the ongoing translation of Dante's Divine Comedy. They are Harvard men, residents of the Yankee Athens. They call themselves the Dante Club. Well, this much is all true. Matthew Pearl has taken the setting and the characters to write a literary murder mystery in which these scholars are challenged to discover the link between the poetry of Dante and a series of grisly deaths drawn carefully from the various circles of hell. His new book, The Dante Club, is in many ways a story of discovering Dante. The poem had been rapturously received in Italy back in the 1300s, but it was only just becoming known in the New World. While Dante's Divine Comedy is now widely regarded as the grand allegory of the Christian afterlife, those who read it and read it and teach it and write about it say today it's more than a literary relic. It has relevance today, just as it did in the bloody aftermath of the Civil War. So, Connection listeners, have you discovered Dante yourself? How do his punishments, carefully crafted to fit the crime, still shape our understanding of justice in the afterlife? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, in the first part of the Divine Comedy, the Inferno, Dante travels through hell with his teacher and guide, the poet Virgil. And it just so happens that we have a teacher and guide and a traveler with us on the program today. Lino Pertile is professor of Romance Languages and Literatures at Harvard University and an authority on Dante. His former pupil is Matthew Pearl, author of The Dante Club. And we have you both together in the studio. I'm so delighted to have you here.
Thanks so much, Dick.
Lino, is it fair to say that The Dante Club began in one way as an assignment from you, the professor?
It is absolutely true. Matthews wrote a senior thesis with that title. He was looking for a subject that would allow him to match his passion for English literature with his newly discovered passion for Dante, and the Dante Club was a perfect candidate for this. And this was his assignment, and he, of course, completed it beautifully.
Now, something about Harvard in 1865, Matthew, also appealed to you. Setting a novel in that time was obviously something that gave you pleasure.
Oh, absolutely. I think part of it, Dick, was that I grew up in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And
we'll forgive you for that.
I hope so. And there are many wonderful things to say about Florida, but one of them is not its history, or at least visible history. You don't get much of a sense of it. But when I came here, I could have felt that I was living in 1865 Harvard. There is so much that survives, that lives, and that we live in not just in Harvard, in Cambridge and Boston, and that was part of what excited me so much about a subject of discovery, because it was a discovery that of the history that had excited me.
It was actually a line in a T.S. Eliot poem that got you started on this. This is even before you met Professor Pertile, is that right?
Right, or more than one line. Rather, the way T.S. Eliot and other modernists whom I had been studying used Dante, and not just used him, but revived him, changed him, transformed him for their own poetry and into their own voice. And that aggressive, assertive claim was so fascinating to me, the way in which Dante changed their voice, I wanted to discover Dante's voice for myself.
Now, you're both very passionate about this poet, and there will be people who have not studied it, a few people who have not studied it as carefully as the two of you. Maybe we should get you to read a little bit, maybe just the very beginning, if I can get you to dust off your Italian for the purposes of this. You could read the beginning in Italian, and Matthew then do the translation.
I'll do my best. Here we go. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai per una selva oscura che la diritta via era smarrita. Ai, quanto a dir qual era e cosa dura esta selva selvaggia e aspra e forte che nel pensier rinnova la paura. Tant'è amara che poco è più morte, ma per trattar del ben chi vi trovai dirò dell'altre cose chi vo scorte.
And Dick, this is the translation by Longfellow, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, its importance. Midway upon the journey of our life, I found myself within a forest dark, for the straightforward pathway had been lost. Ah me, how hard a thing it is to say, what was this forest savage, rough and stern, which in the very thought renews the fear. So bitter is it, death is little more. But of the good to treat, which there I found, speak will I of the other things I saw there.
The very first lines of Dante's Divine Comedy, and I am drawn, I must say, to open my copy of the Dante Club after listening to Lino speak it in his flawless Italian. And I'm going to quote from your book here, because this is, to me, one of the most fascinating things about it. In 1865, the living languages, as you write about them here, were not that popular. In fact, you write, the living languages, as they were called by the Harvard Fellows, were little more than cheap imitations, low distortions. Italian, like Spanish and German, particularly represented the loose political passions, bodily appetites, and absent morals of decadent Europe.
Can I interject here?
I thought you might.
I'd like to say that 1865 is such a symbolic year for the setting of this novel, because it is, of course, 600 years after the birth of Dante. And so 1865 is the rebirth of Dante, or rather the birth of the American Dante. And I think this idea is present throughout the Dante Club, Matthew's book. Matthew's book is really a way in which he fictionalizes the birth of the American Dante, who has been, of course, in this country, in this country's culture for the past 140 years.
Well, Matthew, as you note, there were other writers who in 1865 had tasted Dante, but Longfellow and his Dante Club, was that the first concerted effort to discover Dante in America?
It was, in the sense of a discovery as something that has to do with the public and with the readers. A good counterexample is Emerson, who in the 1840s translated La Vita Nuova, which is another work by Dante, what we translate as The New Life, but, interestingly, never shared it with anyone. We didn't even know about it till almost 100 years later. So it's such a different sense to say that you're going to look at Dante and introduce him, bring him to America as a discovery, as something that we're talking about today. And that discovery was a dramatic one, Dick, because of what you just read, what you brought out from that passage in the novel, which was that there was essentially an embargo from the establishment on these literatures and languages. It was only because professors and poets like Longfellow came to these schools and said, we're going to teach this, we're going to spread this, we're going to be literary missionaries. It's very, very different than what we might imagine as sort of a group of older, sort of antiquarians, you know, losing themselves in this medieval poem. They were doing something bold and brave.
Was it, though, that the Harvard, those well-entrenched in Harvard, were simply trying to defend their place with the classics, the Greek and the Latin, or did it also have to do with the people who were coming into Boston at the time?
Yeah, it's really both, because it's sort of a reverse of what we have today, where many classics departments are struggling for their lives. That was the power structure, as you say. They were essentially in charge of the universities. So on the one hand, anything, any other languages would have seemed a threat to them. But in particular, I'll focus on Italian specifically. Italian was not a language that would have been well known or would have been heard in the immigrants. Most of the immigrants, there were very few Italian immigrants, but there were so many Irish immigrants, and the connection was Catholicism. And that was an extremely threatening, frightening development, discovery in Boston and in other American cities. These cathedrals that were coming up, that we smelled this strange incense and heard these strange chants. There were rumors, Dick, that Protestant girls were being kidnapped and put in the basements to be made into nuns. So we have to remember this atmosphere. And so bringing a literature, a literary property, a literary treasure like Dante, would have been considered dangerous.
And Lino, what about the content of the poem itself? I mean, it's almost, in many cases, pornographic in its description of the violence that happened in the various circles of hell. Were people appalled at that at the time as well?
At the time, you mean in the 14th century, when Dante actually published the...
Well, they loved the Inferno. at the time, did they not, in Italy?
Of course, yes. It is a very graphic, yes.
I'm thinking more of the Puritans and their reception of...
Well, the Protestant reception of Dante has always been ambiguous, because Dante is a fierce critic of the Catholic Church, not the Church as an institution, but the Church as the official carrier of St. Peter's institution. And in fact, in the 16th century, the Protestants loved the Divine Comedy. They didn't think much of purgatory, of course, but hell and paradise were printed in Protestant countries lavishly. And so there has been a kind of ambiguity in the Protestant approach to Dante, really. And the question of violence is not one that is raised very often among Protestant readers, because it is violence for a good reason. It is punishing evil, as it were, and therefore it sort of satisfies the puritanical mentality, I think.
But it certainly, at times, caused a backlash. Voltaire really created almost a century in which Dante was not very well, not known in France, because Voltaire said he was barbaric and he was a madman because of the outrageous violence that he saw in it.
Is that part of the appeal for students as well? Is it like an opening hook that gets them interested? I know there's so much more to the poem. Lino?
I think that the students are attracted by the fact that Dante deals with issues that are still burning in our culture, in our minds, issues that have to do with justice and with rewarding or punishing people for their behavior. I think these are really issues that are still very important in our times, and Dante is a classic that deals with this kind of issues in a very forceful and imaginative and arresting way.
Connection listeners, a professor who will persuade you that Dante has as much to do with your life today as it did in the 1300s. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about a new book, a fictional work called The Dante Club, which deals with a very real club and a very real time, 1865, when the Italian poet and the Divine Comedy first came to the United States. We'll be back after the break with more. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Osama bin Laden.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR.
Per me si va nella città dolente.
Through me the way is to the city dolent.
Per me si va nell'eterno dolore.
Through me the way is to eternal dole.
Per me si va tra la perduta gente.
Through me the way among the people lost.
Giustizia mosse il mio alto fattore.
Justice incited my sublime creator.
Fecemi la divina potestate.
Created me divine omnipotence.
La somma sapienza il primo amore.
The highest wisdom and the primal love.
Dinanzi a me non fuor cose create.
Before me there were no created things.
Se non eterne.
Only eterne.
E io eterno duro.
And I eternal last.
Lasciate ogni speranza, voi che entrate.
All hope abandon, ye who enter in.
Lino Pertile, excuse me, professor of Romance Languages and Literature at Harvard University, authority on Dante, has the Dante professor position once held by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow himself, and Matthew Pearl, author of the new book, The Dante Club, and editor of the new edition of Longfellow's translation of Dante's Inferno, reading from the beginning of the third canto. There's something about hearing it read aloud which gives it life that reading it in text doesn't. But I guess you both already know that.
It's a work of poetry. Poetry is meant to be read aloud. It is written to be read aloud.
And it was read aloud in the Dante Club.
Absolutely. The Dante Club would meet every Wednesday evening in Longfellow's house in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they
cast
would...
list here now. We've got
right.
Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Well, you know them better than I do.
Right.
Who else was in the club?
Well, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow was, let's say, the heart of the club, the emotional and professional heart. He had begun the translation as a way of coping with his wife's terrible death in 1861 at the start of the Civil War, and it was very much intertwined.
Quick aside, how did she die?
She died in an accident involving fire. In fact, it's quite terrible. She was cutting the hair of two of her little girls and sealing them with hot wax on a terribly hot summer day. And somehow, nobody exactly saw what happened. One of these flakes of hot wax went on her dress, and she caught completely on fire.
And ran to the poet.
And Longfellow hugged her to the ground with a rug and put out the fire. In fact, in the process, burning his face so that he could never shave again. This is why he has this long Homeric beard that we sort of associate with him being quaint and archaic. In fact, it was this moment of awful trauma and change and disruption in his life. And she went into a coma and died the next morning.
He never wrote any poetry after
that.
Did.
He wrote poetry, but in the direct aftermath, he could not find the energy, understandably, could not find the energy, the heart to write much of his original poetry that had sustained him for his whole life. And yet for some reason, Dick, Dante was his therapy. He turned to Dante and he found a way of coping, and his friends, who were also Dante enthusiasts, not coincidentally, he had inspired them to be so, rallied around him and formed what they called the Dante Club.
And the other
members briefly were James Russell Lowell, who was a neighbor of Longfellow's, a very famous poet at the time, and Longfellow's successor at Harvard as professor after Longfellow retired. There was also J.T. Fields, who was the most powerful publisher in America. He was Longfellow, Lowell, and their friend's publisher, part of Ticknor and Fields, and ultimately published this translation of Dante in 1867. Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a very, not, we usually think of those three words associated with the Supreme Court justice. This is his father, Dr. Holmes, who was a Harvard Medical School professor and also a very famous poet. And also we can mention George Washington Green, a Revolutionary War historian who would come every week from Rhode Island to attend the Wednesday evening sessions in which they would read aloud Dante, first in Italian, and then in English, and back and forth to compare and to create the voice of Dante.
Now, would they have all read and understood Italian at that time?
To differing degrees. For example, one of the other members I didn't mention just now was Howells, William Dean Howells, eventually a very famous novelist, mm-hmm. who had just returned from Venice as an envoy to Venice during the Civil War. So they all had different experiences, even though, as we discussed, the teaching of Italian was so restricted at the time in America. They had all either traveled abroad or in some other way had aggressively gathered this knowledge that had allowed them to perform this just groundbreaking work.
And Professor Pertile, where do we place the Longfellow translation? If it was the first, it was obviously a groundbreaker, but there have been now so many.
Now it is a huge industry. There are dozens.
I have a copy of my translation. No,
right. Yes. Every week there have been, to be
even lately, there have been quite a few translations, especially of Inferno and Purgatorio. Paradiso is less translated, but even the complete translations are now dozens and dozens into English. And it's a wonderful phenomenon because obviously authors and writers and the translators do find the challenge of Dante sort of irresistible.
But and this is where I want to bring our conversation. It's not just irresistible because it is this curatorial exercise, because it's a relic of literature. It's appealing because as we change, as we grow,
that's right.
The translation can adapt, can it not?
Yes. Dante, as I suppose as all the great classics, has this ability to become accessible and relevant to all the ages, really. And as culture changes, Dante remains, I suppose, a target and the center of interest for people of all ages. And there has been a period in which Dante was not so popular in the 18th century. In fact, Matthew did mention that, did mention Voltaire and so on. The century of the Enlightenment did not like Dante. They found Dante a bit too irrational, too theological, too sort of religious for their liking him. But for instance, the 19th century was extremely fond of Dante, produced hundreds and hundreds of paintings, of musical works, of translations, of re-elaboration, not from the whole work, but just for individual episodes, such as the episodes of Paolo and Francesca, or episode of Ulysses, and episode of Ugolins, where sort of re-elaborate and relived by schools of artists. Just think of the Pre-Raphaelites, what they made of Dante and Beatrice and so on. So there is a huge sort of, it is a huge field, the field of Dante studies.
Is the Longfellow version lost now, Matthew?
No, well, it's interesting. I think you made a good point about translations having different purposes. And Longfellow said that a translator should be like a witness on the stand and hold up his right hand and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And it's still one of the most literal, accurate translations of Dante in existence.
That's right.
But it was almost ironic, because Longfellow and the Dante Club were so successful in opening this window of access to Dante to America, and suddenly there was a whole rush of translations in the end of the 19th century, and as you say now, Longfellow's own translation had been obscured and really buried and out of print now for over 40 years, and in any authoritative form almost 80 years. But today we only 3 weeks ago, we have a new edition from Modern Library of Longfellow's translation of Inferno, and hopefully we will follow with the other two canticles in which Professor Pertelet has written an introduction, and I was fortunate enough to write a preface, hoping that we do return to our origins. And it's interesting to think of literature having origins other than when it was written.
Mm-hmm.
But this is really the origins of Dante in America, and it's a fascinating journey to return to how we made that discovery.
I want to talk a little bit more about what America brought to Dante, but we've people who want to join us by phone. So let's go first to Newton, Massachusetts. Marilyn's on the line. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a small comment about the persistence of the prejudice against vernacular languages in a very odd way. When I was 16 years old, I was accepted as a graduate of Dorchester High School for Girls into Radcliffe College on the condition that I spend 1 year at then Girls Latin School studying Latin. So I was told to go to Girls Latin School and applied to go for a postgraduate year, which I was entitled to as a citizen of Boston. I was turned down by the principal, who dismissed me in literally 30 seconds. He asked me what languages I knew. I told him I knew French very well, which was taught in the schools, and Spanish very well. I didn't tell him that I knew Hebrew, and I didn't even know that Hebrew is a classical language. And he looked at me with at least disdain and said, "You don't belong in a school like this. Our girls do not speak those vernacular languages. Goodbye." And that was it.
This was what?
This was in 1947.
Unbelievable.
That actually happened.
So you didn't go to Radcliffe?
I didn't go to Radcliffe. Later on, I got a doctorate at Harvard, but
well,
I didn't need it.
Marilyn, if I can say so, you are in very good company. You realize that when Dante wrote the Divine Comedy in vernacular, he did something absolutely revolutionary. No one in his time would have written anything serious in vernacular. You know, vernacular was only for inconsequential sort of trivia, such as love poetry, this kind of thing. But all the serious stuff, I mean, especially theological work, would have been written in Latin. And Dante was taken to task a great deal because he chose to write in vernacular. So, I mean, you are in excellent company. So when you begin something new, you have to accept that there are those who will actually object to your departure.
It was just so strange. And interestingly enough, the knowledge of those two vernacular Romance languages led me eventually on my own to try to study Latin because I just loved the languages so much. So anyhow, I just thought it was a sort of interesting anecdote. Now it's an anecdote. At the time, it was devastating.
Yes,
Marilyn, I'm going to ask Matthew Pearl to read a small section from his book, The Dante Club. And Matthew, you should tell us before what's happening here.
Sure.
It sort of plays
sure.
Exactly
absolutely. What Marilyn's talking about is really a vestige of language as warfare, which it really was in the 19th century, and we still obviously have echoes of that. I'll read a short quote from a character in the Dante Club named Augustus Manning, who is a fictional character, but very much based on historical figures who were set against the teaching of these new these living languages. And this is Professor Manning explaining to James Russell Lull, one of the Dante Club loyalists, why he's so passionate about this. "We have been a noble country," Manning says, "with a simplicity of morals and justice, the last orphan child of the great Roman Republic. Our world is strangled and demolished by infiltrators, newfangled notions of immorality coming in with every foreigner and every new idea against all the principles America was built upon. You see it yourself, Professor. Do you think we could have warred against ourselves 20 years ago? We have been poisoned. The war, our war, is far from over. It is just beginning. We have released demons into the very air we breathe. Revolutions, murders, thievery begin in our souls and move into our streets and our houses."
It's Matthew Pearl reading from his new book, The Dante Club. Marilyn, thanks a lot for your call. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll go back to the phones and joining us from Orleans, Massachusetts. Dana, hi.
Hi, good morning to you and your guests. I'm very inspired by, I took a course in Italian literature, being an Italian-American myself. And what really inspired me to read Dante, besides being a Christian, was Franz Liszt. I've always loved the music of Franz Liszt, and he wrote a piece of music from
Dante
his years
Symphony,
of pilgrimage,
yes.
Après un lettore di Dante, after a lecture on Dante by Victor Hugo. It's very passionate and very much, I think, a conveyance of spiritual struggle within a human soul, as Dante must have experienced. He allegedly read this Dante with long hours and with tears, according to the quote, with his mistress, the Countess d'Agoult, when they were traveling, I guess, through Italy. And, and I've done that with friends, too. Like, we've sat, you know, by the beach and we've read Dante. We've, you know, passed the book around reading a few lines, you know. And so, I don't know where to begin when you talk about Dante.
It begs to be read aloud, then, does it, Dana?
Yes. Yes, but I've also read it to myself quite happily when I'm traveling on the subway, on the Red Line sometimes, and I used to live in the Boston area. And but I really would someday, before I go to my grave, I would love to learn the Dante Sonata by Liszt. I think it really conveys what's in the Divine Comedy so much. It's so passionate.
It is a wonderful piece, indeed.
Yeah. Yes.
And I often listen to it myself. Yes.
And I think the Dante Symphony was written around the same time as these Dante Club scholars were working. I think it was around 1859. But I think Dana's anecdote is helpful to remember that there's many Dante Clubs throughout the world, formal and informal, to communicate via Dante. It has this strange power of allowing people to communicate passion and a love for literature.
These are translation clubs or simply reading
clubs? I'm meaning it in more of a dialogue and a conversational sense. A way of using Dante to bond and talk to one another.
Well, you teach this every year.
That's right. Yeah. Mm.
And do you find that you'll always have some students like Dana who become sort of caught, set on fire by the language?
Like Dana and like Matthew and many other students, indeed, who are totally sort of fascinated by Dante and find in Dante something that they were looking for. And keep reading, and sometimes they become themselves the students of Italian. And it is interesting that most American Dantisti, the Dante scholars in America, really are students of English who have discovered Dante and have become Dante specialists in their turn. And so they're not necessarily Italianists, as we would call them, but they are really English literature experts who have found in Dante something that they couldn't find in any other language.
Forgive me, Dana, if I speak over Mr. List. Just to let people know that we're stepping away for a break. We'll be back with more about the Dante Club and Dante being discovered in America. We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at noon, the latest on the capture of a key Al-Qaeda suspect and Turkey's refusal to let the U.S.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Matthew Pearl, author of a new book called The Dante Club. He's also editor of a new edition of Longfellow's translation of Dante's Inferno. And Lino Pertile is also with us. He's a professor of Romance Languages and Literatures at Harvard University, was Matthew's professor. And Matthew, you now teach with Lino Pertile, is that right?
I teach for Lino, I would say. I'm what's called a teaching fellow at Harvard, where I have a section of students that are in Lino's larger Dante course.
How's he doing, Lino? Okay.
He's doing extremely well. What I want to say is that one of the very precious things about this job of ours, the work of teaching, is that you see your students growing and becoming even sort of better than yourself. And this is a great thing that happens to us. And, because then your own submission is more than completed, in a sense. You leave behind more than you actually took, somehow. And this is certainly the case with Matthew, who has now done so much for Dante Studies by publishing this wonderful book.
You've learned something about Dante in America through Matthew's scholarship here.
I have. Well, through Matthew's scholarship, I learned something about a print of a portrait of Dante that I had been carrying around for something like 25 years, having bought it in Brighton, England, in the mid 70s. It was this is a portrait that was discovered in 1841 in Florence. It was discovered by an American student. I suppose his name was Richard Wilde, and then the discovery was attributed to an Englishman called Seymour Kirkup. Anyway, to cut a long story short, a print was made of that in the 1860s, and this print became very, very famous, particularly famous here in America, because it was that new Dante that had appeared in Florence was identified with the new Dante that was appearing in America. At the time.
Did they have a copy of it at the Dante
Club?
Oh,
yes. Longfellow had one at a very special place on his stairwell, and all the members of the Dante Club had one. It really became a symbol for them, as Lino says, of the American part in rediscovering, or more than that, remaking Dante for a new world.
That's right. The most extraordinary thing about this portrait is that having read Matthew's senior thesis, I discovered that, of course, the copy that I had must have been one of this original batch of prints that had been made in the 1860s. And therefore, I decided to put a piece of glass on it just to protect it against the ravages of time.
This is a print you bought in England.
Yes,
right?
Yes. The print that I bought in England. And I decided to do that when I was here.
For something like $2.
No, I bought it for 50p, which is really more like sort of 60 cents. And then sort of, as we were sort of looking for the glass to put on, I opened it at the back. I opened the print at the back, and the backing was still in wood, in fact, and discovered that in the back there was the Boston Times of the 21st of November, 1873.
Wow.
Which, of course, means that Dante had brought me back from England, and then eventually Scotland, where we spent some 7 years, had brought me back here, where it had probably been framed and probably been given as a present from James Russell Lowell to one of his students, something that Lowell used to do at the end of the year. And so I was totally sort of taken aback by this and fascinated by the thought that we had been led here by the print, rather the print of Dante, rather than Dante, than us sort of bringing Dante here. It was a great discovery.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to San Francisco, California. David's joining us and listening in on the web. David, nice to have you here.
Oh, it's really nice to be here and to be there through the magic of the internet. And I just read a review of the Dante Club, and it sounded interesting and fascinating. I was going to reserve it at the library today because it sounds like what a good read.
It is. I recommend.
And what I was thinking about then, as I was reading it, and now to what a great surprise to wake up and be able to ask about this, is that something must have really been happening in New England and to Boston at the time that allowed people to put their minds out to these different, what would seem to be, must have been a very different culture, this Catholic culture, Dante in Italy, and also I'm thinking of Emerson and his circle, who began to take an interest in Eastern thought, in Buddhism and Hinduism for the first time. And I just wondered what it was like, the atmosphere, and also, of course, there was politically, people were interested in abolition, and there seemed to be new thought and new thinking and new ways of thinking and willingness to explore cultures and thought that hadn't been happening before.
It's more than just coincidence, Matthew, that at a time when, and I began the program this way, when the country was so badly scarred from the Civil War, that this debate over Dante was taking place, because the issues that Lino was talking about justice and understanding, you know, who you are, where you've been, where you're going, these are all to be found in Dante to a certain extent.
Absolutely, and even war. Dante wrote in the shadow of constant civil strife in Florence, and it was a product of that he was exiled. And if he had not been exiled and put in this position of essentially solitude from his home, he probably would have never written this poem. So all of that is contained therein, and all of that is part of Dante's journey. But we mentioned some of the forces that would have compelled Dante to be restricted. But there was this new openness that we can see in the 19th century. And part of that is that it was Longfellow's name on this translation. Longfellow was the most famous poet in America. He was completely beloved.
Do you think he gave some legitimacy to it, or just drew some attention to it?
I think both. I think people paid attention to what this was because Longfellow had devoted so much of himself into this, and his name allowed carried Dante to so many new readers, and the Dante Club was aware. They saw themselves as taking Dante out of exile, very much so, historical exile and sort of literary exile.
But the second and the third circle of hell, this is no Hiawatha.
Right, exactly. And that's what still people are surprised who don't know that Longfellow had this amazing achievement, that it was he who did this.
The nice touch, really, is that Matthew, too, had to go into exile to write his novel. He didn't write it in Cambridge, he wrote it in New Haven, as he was going to the law school at Yale. So and during this exile, he wrote the Dante Club, came back, and to a lot of acclaim. It didn't happen
to
Dante.
This isn't coming from a Harvard man, of course.
Right.
It didn't happen to Dante, of course, who died in exile. But,
see, he was allowed back. That's the difference.
Right, they let me back in.
Yes.
1-800-423-8255 to Isabel now, who's joining us from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Isabel.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
I wanted to thank you, first of all, for such a wonderful topic for this program. I'm actually learning a lot that I had no idea existed.
Me too.
Starting with Longfellow. I knew of Longfellow, but not that of his fascination with Dante and his translation. But I wanted to make a couple of comments and one question. First of all, I wanted to say that when I first read Dante's Inferno, I was probably a sophomore in college. And I have to say, probably to the disappointment of the professor, that one of the things that really stayed with me for a long time was actually the gory details. And that was surprising to me because I'm not a person that actually even goes to horror movies. I really don't enjoy anything violent. I do not subject myself to any such things. And yet I remember that for months and months that stayed, and it almost became an inside reference with friends and classmates, particularly the case of one person that was punished by walking around with maggots devouring his skin on his back. And it just really stayed with me. That was one. The other thing that really struck me was the fact that certain famous characters from history that had been born before the birth of Christ or before, you know, the Christianity had even been spread, were punished, were also sent, I don't remember if to the purgatory or to the inferno. And I remember it struck me as terribly unfair that they could be punished for something that they had not known about. And lastly, I actually had a question, and I was wondering, I've never read the Paradiso, and I'm wondering if it was written under completely different circumstances, and just generally, how is it like? Because it's hard to imagine reading the Inferno with such a vengeful and in some ways kind of self-righteous, although really fascinating, world created there. It's hard to imagine the Paradiso after that, so I'm just a little bit curious. I'll have to...
All right, Isabel, I'll thank you for your call. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. A quick answer on the Paradiso.
Well, there is no Inferno without Paradiso. There is no Paradiso without Inferno. You really must go back to the Dante and read Paradiso as soon as possible. No, because Dante has this extraordinary latitude. He does include the very gory details you are talking about, but then there is also the sublime happiness, the beatitude of Paradiso, and that should not be forgotten, of course. And the Paradiso was not written under different circumstances. It was written as a continuum. We think that Dante started writing around 1306 and ended just before he died in 1321, about 15 years.
And Matthew, it's, I don't suppose, just a coincidence that in the Inferno, Dante and Virgil keep coming across characters from history, and you were able to, in many ways, take advantage of the same thing by pulling characters from American history in Dante.
Yeah, exactly, Dick. I think, in a way, Dante was what we might now call a historical fiction writer, because he's able to combine these historical figures with fictional and mythological figures and put them in a new setting and say, this is all real. This really happened, which he says, in particular, he emphasizes at the most incredible, fantastical moments. He says, I swear to you, my reader, this is true. And that's what historical fiction does. That's what my own historical fiction novel tries to accomplish, which is to recast history in a new light, to pressure it, to put a moment of trauma or moments of trauma that forces it to present itself in a new way and to make us think about it in a new way. And that's why the Dante Club in the novel must confront the violence. No. Like Isabel, I'm not naturally inclined to that, but it's part of the journey to get past that. And Isabel, you might want to reread Inferno, because despite the grotesque moments and the violence, there's still humanity that comes through that, that transcends
Absolutely.
That, even in
yeah.
Inferno, even long before yeah. we get to Paradiso. And that's part of what's so spectacular about it.
Should we tell her that the maggots make an appearance in the
Dante
Club?
And the maggots make a very prominent appearance in the Dante Club, that are usually the first thing that people say to me when they've read the novel is, those maggots.
To be fair to Dante, they are much less prominent in Dante's Inferno yes. than they are in the Dante Club.
Just one line, I think.
That's right.
What was his fascination with the number three?
His fascination.
Was enchanted by the number three, Dante.
Number three is not only Dante, but number three is almost a sacred number because of the Trinity, because of the... you know, all the fascination with numbers is rather sort of is understandable, I suppose, but difficult to explain to those who don't share it.
It's a very scholastic way of thinking.
Yeah, it goes back to, of course, to Pythagoras and the view of the cosmos as being sort of numerically ordained.
Somehow. I ask you because, of course, it is the third day of the third month of the third year of the third millennia that we happen to be sitting here together.
On the other hand, you see, you are playing with numbers because it is 2003, and that in you can't get three into 2003. So, no, it's,
oh,
it's
two,
and two and three makes five, you know. Dante wouldn't have stood for this, you know. Either you get perfect, the numbers are perfect, or you just don't use them.
All right, we won't use them, but I will thank the two of you for coming in. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Dick. It was wonderful.
Lino Pertele is professor of Romance Languages and Literature at Harvard University. Matthew Pearl is author of a new book called The Dante Club. And Connection listeners, you can learn more about Dante and The Dante Club on our website. We're at theconnection.org, and we'll have links on those websites that will take you other places to discover more about Matthew and his research and the new Longfellow edition. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
Matthew Pearl will speak about his novel, The Dante Club, on Thursday, February 6th at 12:30 at Borders in Boston. For more information, CheckTheConnection.org. This is WBUR. Coming up next on Here and Now, the latest on the capture of alleged Al-Qaeda mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. That story in the news of the day, next on Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Salem 5 Commercial Banking, offering a full